Thing, a patient story. John learned the truth about prediabetes the hard way. He was a 49-year-old salesman who'd spent his career going from job site to job site. One day, after 10 years of eating fast food on the run, John experienced that dreaded, crushing chest pain and left arm pain. That heart attack got his attention, along with the associated angiogram and the need for two stents to open his clogged arteries. He came to see me wondering what had happened. He thought he was healthy, albeit a little overweight. He didn't have high blood pressure or diabetes, and his cholesterol was normal at 173. What he didn't know was that he had pre-diabetes, and his doctor had not picked it up in his yearly physical. His diet was pretty typical for an American male. Fast food, burgers, fries, soda, chips. He drank about 2 beers a day. The only green thing he ate were green M&Ms. Over 10 years, during which he suffered a stressful relationship and the death of his mother, he gained 50 pounds, and his waist went from 32 to 36 inches. His blood tests showed normal blood sugar and cholesterol, but a very low good cholesterol, or HDL of 34, ideal is greater than 60. And he had a fatty liver caused by his sugary processed diet. When we looked a little deeper, we found that after a sugar drink, which as I said is the best way to test for prediabetes and diabetes, his insulin and his blood sugar skyrocketed, a clear sign of prediabetes. We also found he had dangerous small dense cholesterol particles, even on Lipitor, and he had high levels of mercury. He lived in the Gulf and ate a lot of fish. His omega-3 fats, EPA and DHA, which help normalize blood sugar and improve insulin sensitivity and reduce the risk of heart disease, were low even though he ate fish. By the time I saw him, he was on a cabinet full of medication, including a beta blocker, which made him tired, and a whopping 80 milligrams, or 8 times the starting dose of Lipitor, which can cause more insulin resistance and increase the risk of diabetes. Statins such as Lipitor also lower coenzyme Q10, which is needed for cells to make energy and burn calories. He was put on a blood pressure pill, an ACE inhibitor, 2 blood thinners, Plavix and aspirin. He lost a few pounds right after his heart attack, but he still had a long way to go. So I put him on the blood sugar solution, and over the course of a year, he went from a fast food eating, soda drinking, pill popping, big bellied guy to a thin, fit, healthy man. He lost 62 pounds and gained 30 years of life back. He took up running. He got healthier and healthier. We gave him special nutrients to improve insulin sensitivity, including biotin, chromium, lipoic acid, vitamin D3, and PGX, the special super fiber to lower blood sugar, insulin, cholesterol, and cut cravings. And we gave him fish oil. I also gave him high-dose niacin, or vitamin B3, to raise his good cholesterol and turn his dangerous, small, dense LDL particles into large, light, fluffy ones. And I corrected the deficiency of coenzyme Q10 induced by the Lipitor. We boosted his liver detoxification system with N-acetylcysteine, a supplement, and helped his body get rid of the mercury. We helped him thin his blood with natural blood thinners, and after a year, he was no longer on any of the medication he started on. No Lipitor, no blood pressure meds, no blood thinners, and all of his numbers were better than when he was actually on the medication. His blood sugar was 93. His total cholesterol went from 173 on the medication to 137 off the medication, while his good cholesterol went from 34 to 58. And all of his particles now were light and fluffy. These are better results than any medication can achieve. His fatty liver was healed, and at 50 years old, he was healthier than ever. John's heart attack happened because of his pre-diabetes. In fact, one study found that about 2/3 of all patients admitted to the emergency room with heart attacks had either pre-diabetes or undiagnosed diabetes. Another important study found that the risk of heart attacks increases with any increase in average blood sugar, even those who don't have diabetes. Taking statins and beta blockers, which actually cause insulin resistance, would not have corrected John's prediabetes. They're like mopping up the floor while the sink overflows. Most people believe that prediabetes isn't a problem until it becomes full-blown diabetes. Then it's just a warning sign. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It's an earlier stage of diabetes that carries with it nearly all the risks of diabetes. Prediabetes can kill you before you ever get to diabetes through heart attacks, strokes, and even cancer. Prediabetes can even cause pre-dementia or mild cognitive impairment. Think of it as early Alzheimer's. Recent studies have shown that diabetics have a four-fold increased risk of developing Alzheimer's, and patients with prediabetes or metabolic syndrome have a dramatically increased risk of pre-dementia or mild cognitive impairment known as MCI. You don't even have to have diabetes to have brain damage and memory loss from high insulin levels and insulin resistance. Just having prediabetes can give you pre-dementia. Alzheimer's disease is actually now being called type 3 diabetes. Recent studies have found that as your waist size goes up, the size of your brain goes down. Your brain function is also impaired. One extraordinary brain imaging study by Dr. Daniel Amen and his colleagues found that obesity was associated with decreased blood flow in your frontal cortex, the portion of your brain that controls executive decision-making, like, should I have that donut right now or not? And if that's not bad enough, prediabetes can also cause impotence in men and infertility in women. It can be related to polycystic ovarian syndrome. So if your doctor has diagnosed you with prediabetes or metabolic syndrome, don't think that you are only at risk for something in the future, such as diabetes or heart attack. The problems are happening right now. Myth 4. Once you start on insulin, there is no going back. Insulin treatment in diabetes is a slippery slope because increased insulin dosage often leads to increased weight gain, higher blood pressure, and elevated cholesterol. Remember, insulin is a fat storage hormone that also drives your appetite and inflammation. Your blood sugar improves, but your overall risk of heart disease does not. That's why insulin should be the last resort in managing blood sugar and diabetes. If you have to be on insulin, get on the lowest dose possible. Eating whole, real, fresh food and exercising vigorously will keep your blood sugar low and your insulin needs down. The good news is that with aggressive lifestyle intervention and dietary change, you can reverse diabetes and stop insulin therapy under your doctor's supervision. Many of my patients and my colleagues' patients have successfully gotten off insulin. By understanding and treating all of the underlying causes of diabetes, the possibility exists not only of eliminating insulin treatment, but also reversing diabetes and insulin resistance, curing it. This is not seen as much in conventional medical care because the type of diet and lifestyle intervention advice is not adequate or properly designed to create a reversal or a cure for diabetes. It is possible with the right treatment approach based on functional medicine and new models of group care and community support that teach sustainable behavior change and nutritional life skills like cooking and shopping, exercise, and mind-body skills. Myth 5. Lowering blood sugar with medication prevents death and heart attacks in diabetics. Avandia, the world's number one blockbuster diabetes drug, contributed to the deaths of 47,000 people from heart disease in the first 11 years of its use. This data was hidden from the government and the public most of that time. We have to give up on the hope for the magic pill that will fix our problems. Large drug trials have attempted to prove that targeting risk factors such as cholesterol or blood sugar levels with drugs reduces the risk of heart disease, diabetes, and death. Despite hundreds of millions of research dollars spent over many decades, aggressive risk factor treatment of the two most important targets, cholesterol and blood sugar, has consistently failed to show benefit in preventing disease, although treatment may be helpful if you've already had a heart attack. Recent large trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine have confirmed that by treating risk factors with drugs, not only may we be ineffective in preventing heart attacks, diabetes, and death, but we may also be creating harm by ignoring the root causes of disease. Chronic disease is not due to a drug deficiency. High cholesterol is not a Lipitor deficiency. High blood sugar is not an Avandia deficiency. Isolating one risk factor, or even separately treating multiple risk factors, will fail until it is done in the context of addressing the upstream drivers of disease. Everyone loves the idea of popping a pill to fix the problem. Cardiologists advocate handing out statins at fast food restaurants. Taking Lipitor at the same time you're consuming a cheeseburger, fries, and a soda misses the point. Those foods kill you in ways that have nothing to do with your cholesterol. They make you insulin resistant. They don't give you the fiber, vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants that real food does. What's worse, new research shows that statins don't work for prevention, even though over 75% of prescriptions for statins are given to prevent heart disease. They do work to prevent a second heart attack, but not the first one. The independent Cochrane Collaboration performed a comprehensive review of the research using statins to prevent heart disease by examining 14 major studies involving 34,000 patients at low risk for a heart attack. They found little or no benefit. If you haven't already had a heart attack, these drugs won't help you prevent one, despite misleading drug ads or your doctor's advice. In addition to the Cochrane review, many other studies also support this and point out the frequent and significant side effects that come with taking these drugs. In 10 to 15% of patients who take them, they cause muscle damage, cramps, muscle weakness, and aching. They cause exercise intolerance, even in the absence of pain or elevated CPK, which are muscle enzymes. They also can cause sexual dysfunction, liver and nerve damage, and other problems. They also cause significant cellular, muscle, and nerve injury and cell death, even in the absence of symptoms. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association examined 5 major clinical trials on statins, including 32,752 non-diabetics over 4.9 years. During the study period, 2,749 patients, or 8.4%, developed diabetes. Those on the highest doses of the statins, which are increasingly prescribed by doctors, were at the highest risk of getting diabetes. If all doctors followed the latest cholesterol treatment guidelines and all their patients took their prescribed statin medication, there would be 3.5 million more diabetics in America. Oops. There is no lack of research calling into question the benefit of statins. Unfortunately, that research doesn't get the benefit of billions of dollars of marketing and advertising that statins do. Should diabetics not try to control their blood sugar? Yes, they should. It's clear that elevated blood sugar causes small vessel injury, leading to blindness, kidney damage, nerve damage, and cataracts. And the major causes of death in diabetics are heart attacks, heart disease, and strokes. But these problems are best addressed not through medication, but by treating the root causes. It's the elevated levels of insulin that cause the high blood pressure or the abnormal cholesterol and the inflammation, not high blood sugars. Lowering your blood sugar without addressing the underlying causes gives you a false sense of security and leads you to believe that you're doing something good to prevent heart attacks and early death. Unfortunately, the evidence shows otherwise. Tragically, insurance doesn't usually pay for the right treatment. Intensive lifestyle therapy, although I believe soon this will change. No one profits from lifestyle medicine, so it's not part of medical education or practice. Most doctors know more about treating malaria when they graduate from medical school than treating diabetes. It should be the foundation of our healthcare system, but doctors ignore it because they get paid to dispense medication and perform surgery. But they should be paid to develop and conduct practice-based and community programs and sustainable lifestyle change. The future of medical care must be to transform general lifestyle guidance, those mandates to eat a healthy diet and get regular exercise that many physicians try to provide to their patients, into individually tailored lifestyle prescriptions for both the prevention and the treatment of chronic diseases. And delivering lifestyle interventions through small groups is the most powerful way to create sustainable behavior change. Remember, it's easier to get healthy together. Lifestyle is often the best medicine when applied correctly, and it's the only thing that will get us started on the road to reversing this global health crisis. Myth 6. Heart surgery and angioplasty are good treatments for diabetics with heart disease. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that surgery and angioplasty for diabetics with heart disease work no better than medication in reducing heart attacks and deaths and have higher risks. How unproven treatments can kill, a patient's story. Dan's dad was diabetic. He had the best medical, pharmaceutical, and surgical care available. Nevertheless, he suffered from very poor health. He went to the emergency room with chest pain and was quickly shuttled into the cath lab for an angiogram. He was told he needed a cardiac bypass operation, even though research evidence has shown no reduced risk of mortality for cardiac bypass or angioplasty in diabetics. Not providing effective treatment is one thing, but providing harmful, costly, and ineffective treatment like this is unethical. After the bypass, Dan's father developed a post-operative infection of MRSA, this antibiotic-resistant killer staph bacteria, in his sternum, which led to a month in the intensive care unit. He then needed plastic surgery to repair the chest defect left after the surgeons removed his infected sternum. And then he had mini strokes, which led to pre-dementia and a protracted recovery from hospitalization, requiring months of home care. The surgery and the subsequent therapy with blood thinners and cholesterol and blood pressure-lowering medications did not enhance the quality of his health or his life. In fact, he declined rapidly, physically and mentally, and died of a stroke. Dan's father was not offered the treatment that would have cost less than 2% of the $400,000 his care actually cost, and would have likely created an infinitely enhanced quality of life by actually reversing the underlying causes of his diabetes and heart disease. If he were simply provided the choice of a different treatment, an individual or group program for sustainable and comprehensive lifestyle change based on the principles in the blood sugar solution, perhaps he would still be alive and our national debt would have been reduced by $400,000. It should be our right to have access to these proven treatments that provide better value for the individual and for the healthcare system. Myth 7. Weight loss is necessary for the reversal of diabetes. At an American Diabetes Association convention in New York City, the main booth front and center in the convention hall presented a breakthrough cure for diabetes, the surgical treatment of diabetes with gastric bypass surgery. Unfortunately, I have seen many patients who gain back all the weight they lost and more after gastric bypass. My patient Alan, for instance, had been overweight since he was 6 years old and never experienced a day without ravenous hunger. At 40 years old, he had a gastric bypass and went from 450 pounds to 250 pounds, but then gained back 100 pounds. At 60 years old, Alan was sick and tired, and he had to deal with all the complications of gastric bypass surgery. Gastric bypass is touted as a solution for obesity. In fact, the number of gastric bypass surgeries performed each year has increased tenfold in about 10 years to about 230,000 a year, at 30,000 a pop. While this approach works for some, clearly it's not the answer for an epidemic of diabetes. And it often fails, and it can cause many complications, including vomiting and malnutrition. Shrinking someone's stomach to the size of a walnut with surgery is one way to battle obesity and may be life-saving for a few, but it doesn't address the underlying causes. And many will regain the weight because they didn't change the understanding of their bodies or their relationship to food. Clearly, weight loss is critical and it's important for obtaining optimal health. However, what we're finding in patients who have gastric bypass surgery is that even a dramatic change in diet in a short period of time creates dramatic metabolic changes without weight loss. All the parameters that we thought were related to obesity, such as high blood sugar, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, inflammation, and clotting, are dramatically reduced even without significant weight loss because of the rapid effects of dietary changes that control which genes get turned on or turned off. This is called nutrigenomics, the way food talks to your genes. While weight loss is important, what's more important is the quality of food you put in your body. Food is information that quickly changes your metabolism and your genes. And in a short time, you can upgrade your biological software by eating real, whole, fresh, quality food. The converse is also true, as we learned in a study in the New England Journal of Medicine that discussed a woman who'd had 20 kilos, more than 40 pounds of abdominal fat, removed by liposuction. She showed no changes in any of her metabolic markers of obesity, including blood sugar, cholesterol, blood pressure, and inflammation, despite losing 20 kilos, and she was still sick. The take-home message is that the quality of the food we put in our bodies drives our gene function, our metabolism, and our health. It's not simply a matter of your weight or of calories in, calories out. Eating powerful, gene-altering, whole, real, fresh food that you cook yourself can rapidly change your biology. You will lose weight by getting your systems in balance, not by starving yourself. The blood sugar solution is like getting a gastric bypass without the pain of surgery, vomiting, or malnutrition. Chapter 4, Food Addiction, Fixing Your Brain Chemistry. Whatever happened to old-fashioned willpower? Everybody knows that the obesity epidemic is a matter of personal responsibility. People should exercise more self-control. They should avoid overeating and reduce their intake of sugar-sweetened drinks and processed food. There are no good or bad foods. It's everything in moderation, right? This sounds good in theory, except for one thing. New discoveries in science prove that sugar, processed food, fat, and salt-laden food, food that's made in a plant rather than grown on a plant, as Michael Pollan, the author of In Defense of Food, would say, is biologically addictive. Remember that old potato chip commercial with the tagline, "Bet you can't eat just one"? I bet you can't imagine that kind of commercial for broccoli or apples. No one binges on those foods. Yet it's easy to imagine a mountain of potato chips, a whole bag of cookies, or a pint of ice cream vanishing quickly in an unconscious reptilian brain-eating frenzy. Broccoli is not addictive, but chips, cookies, ice cream, soda can become addictive as any drug. In the 1980s, First Lady Nancy Reagan championed the just say no approach to drug addiction. Unfortunately, that approach hasn't fared too well, and it won't work for industrial food addiction either. There are specific biological mechanisms that drive addictive behavior. Nobody chooses to be a heroin addict, a cokehead, or a drunk. Nobody chooses to have a food addiction either. These behaviors arise from primitive neurochemical reward centers in the brain that override normal willpower. And in the case of food addictions, they overwhelm the ordinary biological signals that control hunger. Why is it so hard for obese people to lose weight, despite the social stigma, despite the health consequences, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, and even cancer, and despite their intense desire to lose weight? It's not because they want to be fat. It's because in the vast majority of cases, certain types of food, processed foods made of sugar, fat, and salt, combined in ways kept secret by the food industry, are addictive. We are biologically wired to crave these foods and eat as much of them as possible. Are you addicted? While some of us may be genetically more predisposed to the addictive properties of food or heroin or alcohol, if you examine your own behavior and your relationship to sugar in particular, you will likely find that your behavior around sugar matches up perfectly with why you can't control your diabetes. Take the food addiction test in the companion PDF. Once you've taken the quiz, use the following scale developed by the researchers from Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity to determine if you have a food addiction. If you find yourself scoring 3 or higher, or answering yes to more than 2 of the questions, you may be suffering from food addiction. Based on these psychological criteria and new neurologic research, many of us, including most obese children, are addicted to industrial food. Let's review some of the scientific findings confirming that food can indeed be addictive. First, sugar stimulates the brain's pleasure or reward centers through the neurotransmitter dopamine, exactly like other addictive drugs. Second, brain imaging and PET scans show that high sugar and high fat foods work just like heroin, opium, or morphine in the brain. Third, brain imaging scans also show that obese people and drug addicts have lower numbers of dopamine receptors, making them more likely to crave things that boost dopamine, and this in part is genetically determined. Fourth, foods high in fat and sweets stimulate the release of the body's own opioids, chemicals like morphine in the brain. Five, drugs we use to block the brain's receptors for heroin and morphine, called naltrexone, also reduce the consumption and preference for sweet and high-fat foods in both normal weight and obese binge eaters. Six, people and rats develop a tolerance to sugar. They need more and more of the substance to satisfy themselves. This is true of drugs such as alcohol or heroin. Seven, obese individuals continue to eat a large amount of unhealthy foods despite severe social and personal negative consequences, just like addicts and alcoholics. Eight, animals and humans experience withdrawal when suddenly cut off from sugar, just like addicts detoxifying from drugs. And nine, just like drugs, after an initial period of enjoyment from the food, the user consumes it not to get high, but to feel normal. Remember the movie Super Size Me, in which Morgan Spurlock ate 3 meals from McDonald's every day? What struck me about the film was not that he gained 24.5 pounds or that his cholesterol went up, or even that he got a fatty liver. What was surprising was the portrait it painted of the addictive quality of the food. At the beginning of the movie, after he ate his first supersized meal, he threw it up, just like a teenager who drinks too much alcohol at his first party. By the end of the movie, he only felt well when he ate that junk food. The rest of the time, he felt depressed, exhausted, anxious, and irritable, and lost his sex drive, just like an addict or a smoker withdrawing from his drug. The food was clearly addictive. The problem of food addiction is compounded by the fact that food manufacturers refuse to release any internal data on how they put the ingredients together to maximize consumption of their products, despite requests from researchers and government. In his book, The End of Overeating, David Kessler, MD, the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, describes the science of how food is made into drugs through the creation of hyperpalatable foods that lead to neurochemical addiction. The special case of liquid calories. Liquid sugar calories are the most addictive food in our diet. Sugar-sweetened beverages are a unique category of food. Aside from being the single biggest source of added sugar in the diet, Sugary drinks drive diabetes and obesity in ways that solid food, even solid junk food, doesn't. And many of these beverages also are loaded with caffeine, which compounds their addictive properties. Why are sugar-sweetened drinks so bad for us? Here's a few good reasons. One, if you drink your calories in sweetened beverages, you don't reduce your solid calories to compensate. So not only are these empty calories, but they're extra calories you normally wouldn't eat. Two, from 1997 to 2002, consumption of calories in sugar-sweetened beverages doubled and is the main source of added sugar calories to our diet. During that time period, obesity rates doubled in children ages 2 to 11 and tripled in adolescents from ages 12 to 19. More than 90% of American children and teenagers drink sodas every day. 90%. Liquid calories account for up to 10 to 15% of the total daily calorie consumption of the average teenager. The average consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages is 175 calories a day. Since these calories are in addition to calories from solid food, this would add 18 pounds to the average person's weight each year. Each can of soda consumed by children per day increases their risk of being overweight by 60%. Soft drinks are the largest source of added sugar to children's diets. Researchers from Harvard's Children's Hospital showed in a randomized trial that if provided with easy access to alternatives to sugar-sweetened beverages, kids would reduce their intake of sugar-sweetened drinks by 82% and have significant weight loss. In the Nurses' Health Study of 91,249 women, those who had one sugar-sweetened soft drink a day had an 82% higher risk of having diabetes over 4 years. Those who drank fruit punch doubled their risk of developing diabetes. Other studies also link sugar-sweetened drinks to pre-diabetes and diabetes, particularly in African Americans, and heart disease. A review of over 30 studies published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found clear evidence that drinking sugar-sweetened beverages led to weight gain. Bottom line, when you drink your calories, you don't feel full, so you end up eating more overall. A large study by Harvard scientists funded by the Center for Disease Control and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation found that if people drank water instead of sodas, they would consume 225 fewer calories a day, equivalent to about one soft drink. In a year, that's 82,123 fewer calories. That amounts to a weight loss of 24 pounds a year just by switching to non-sugar sweetened drinks. So what should we be drinking? Water. Tap water. Filter it, chill it, squeeze a little lemon juice in it, and enjoy it. We've been brainwashed to think we can't drink just water, but it's what we're made of, and it will help you lose weight. In fact, researchers found that drinking water before meals increases weight loss by about 44%. There's ample proof that sugar-sweetened drinks are harmful to our health. But even if they weren't, shouldn't manufacturers of these products have to prove they're safe rather than expect underfunded scientists to prove they're harmful? There have been some studies that found little or no association between weight gain and sugar-sweetened beverages. However, many of these studies were funded by the food industry, including the American Beverage Association, formerly known as the American Soft Drink Association. In fact, in 2007, a review of more than 206 scientific studies found that if the food industry funded the study, there was up to an eightfold likelihood of the study findings proving favorable to the food industry. A little known fact, but one that everybody should know, is that many food industry Goliaths banded together to form the, quote, Center for Consumer Freedom, which has created a media campaign stating that the obesity epidemic is a hoax. They tell us, don't believe your eyes, believe us. Owing to, quote, privacy concerns, the website won't reveal its funders. Investigators discovered that Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Kellogg, Kraft, and others were behind this, but wanted to remain anonymous because, as reported on the website, they were afraid of food fascists, those vegetable-eating, organic gardening militia groups. Oh my! Diet drinks. Helpful or harmful? If you're thinking that diet soft drinks are the answer, think again. Diet drink consumption has increased 400% since 1960. They may or may not cause cancer, but the evidence is mounting that they lead to weight gain rather than weight loss. Those who consume diet drinks regularly have a 200% increased risk of weight gain, a 36% increased risk of prediabetes, and a 67% increased risk of diabetes. A study of over 400 people found that those who drank two diet sodas a day had five times the increase in waist circumference as those who did not drink soda. Seems you can't outsmart Mother Nature. Fooling your brain into thinking you're getting something sweet plays dirty tricks on your metabolism. Artificial sweeteners disrupt the normal hormonal and neurologic signals that control hunger and satiety, which means feeling full. A study of rats that were fed artificially sweetened food found that their metabolism slowed down and that they were triggered to consume more calories and gain more weight than rats fed sugar-sweetened food. In another alarming study, rats offered the choice of cocaine or artificial sweeteners always picked the artificial sweetener, even if the rats were previously programmed to be cocaine addicts. The author of the study said that, quote, "The absolute preference for taste sweetness may lead to a reordering in the hierarchy of potentially addictive stimuli, with sweetened diets taking precedence over cocaine and possibly other drugs of abuse." The use of artificial sweeteners, as well as food porn, a sexy experience of sweet fat and salt in your mouth, alters your food preferences. Your palate shifts from being able to enjoy fruits and vegetables and whole foods to liking only the sexy stuff. My advice is to give up stevia, aspartame, sucralose, sugar alcohols such as xylitol and maltitol, and all of the other heavily used and marketed sweeteners unless you want to slow down your metabolism, gain weight, and become an addict. Under the Food Stamp Program, or SNAP, the U.S. Department of Agriculture spends $4 billion a year on soda for the poor. That buys almost 30 million servings a day, or over 10 billion servings of corn sugar sweetened drinks a year. The government and our taxes pays now and pays later through ballooning Medicaid and Medicare costs for obesity and diabetes-driven disease. They won't revise their policy because they say it's discriminatory to prevent the purchase of soda. To whom, I ask? The poor or the industrial food and agriculture giants? The soda tax. Thomas Frieden, the director of the Center for Disease Control, and Kelly Brownell of Yale University authored an article in the New England Journal of Medicine advocating for a penny-an-ounce sugar tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, known around the country as the soda tax. Just as taxing cigarettes has reduced smoking, it's estimated that this tax would reduce soda consumption by 23% a year. The 10-year savings in healthcare costs would be $50 billion. The increased revenue to strapped state governments would be $150 billion a year. Now, taxing sugar-sweetened beverages would not eradicate obesity, but liquid calories are proving to be a clear target for public health intervention. Doing this could generate revenue for obesity prevention and treatment programs and reduce soda consumption. Funds from this initiative could be earmarked for the community programs that we need to address obesity in adults and children, especially for the poor. This would cost nothing and have immediate impact. It could supersize the efforts of Michelle Obama, who has only $400 million a year to fight obesity in children. The American Beverage Association, led by Coca-Cola and Pepsi, spent $1 million lobbying against this idea in 2000. In 2009, they spent $20 million. If they didn't think it would affect policy or consumption, they wouldn't fight it. Their own internal studies show that when Coke increased the prices by 12%, their sales dropped 14.6%. we can alter the default conditions in the environment that foster and promote diabesity and addictive behavior. It's simply a matter of public and political will. If we don't, we will face an ongoing epidemic of obesity and illness across the nation and across the globe. If pushed, big farming can start growing healthy food to feed the nation, and big food can come up with innovative solutions to satisfy consumers and supply healthful, economical, convenient, and delicious foods for our world. However, these industries will not police themselves. And if the foods they market are addictive, what are the ethical, legal, and moral implications of allowing these food pushers unrestricted access to our children? Chapter 5, How Big Food, Big Farming, and Big Pharma Are Killing Us. What is the driving force behind all the cheap, low-quality foods that are little more than combinations of fat, sugar, and salt, and as we saw in the last chapter, have proven to be as addictive as any drug? Junk food, produced from and made cheap by government subsidies, such as the 2010 Farm Bill, are heavily marketed to the tune of $30 billion a year by mega food corporations such as Altria, formerly known as Philip Morris Kraft, ConAgra, Cargill, Tyson, Sara Lee, Unilever, General Mills, Kellogg, Coca-Cola, and PepsiCo. Government subsidization is how a Twinkie with 39 different ingredients and a hefty marketing budget costs less than a head of broccoli. These processed foods are heartily consumed by our ever-widening population, driving obesity rates up to nearly 3 out of every 4 Americans. The more they eat, the fatter they become. The fatter they become, the more they develop heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and a myriad of other chronic illnesses. The sicker our population, the more medications are sold by Big Pharma for high cholesterol, diabetes, high blood pressure, depression, and many other lifestyle-driven diseases. One of the leading products of the American food industry has become patients for the American healthcare industry. The toxic triad of big farming, big food, and big pharma profits from a nation of sick and fat citizens. The government essentially stands in line next to you in the fast food chains, helping you buy cheeseburgers, fries, and cola. But in the produce aisle of your supermarket, you are on your own. The 2010 Farm Bill provided $42 billion in subsidies to big farming to encourage the production of cheap sugar from corn and fats from soybeans. It did not offer support for farmers to grow fruits, vegetables, or healthy whole foods. Aside from subsidies for corn, sugar, and wheat, the Farm Bill does almost nothing to support the production of whole, fresh, local, seasonal, or organic produce. That's one reason why everywhere you look, in stores, schools, and government institutions and food programs, you find cheap, high-calorie, nutrient-poor processed foods or food-like substances. It has become increasingly difficult to avoid making food choices that drive obesity, especially when the price of fruits and vegetables has increased 5 times as fast as sugar-sweetened beverages. It's not a coincidence that the poorest states, such as Mississippi, in our country, are also the fattest. Poverty makes it impossible to make the best food choices, and poverty rates are higher than they have been in a generation. Not only are healthier foods almost always more expensive, they are often not available in poor neighborhoods. This combination of factors is a direct link to obesity and diabetes. Our government has not been very helpful in these areas. Its focus has been on education, like the food pyramid or the new My Plate initiative, and on encouraging personal responsibility rather than on regulating big food. Government actions are at best anemic. In 2011, the Federal Trade Commission and other government agencies announced new food marketing guidelines. These agencies would like big food to refrain from marketing foods to children with trans fats or more than 15% saturated fat, 210 milligrams of sodium, or 13 grams of added sugar per serving. But this was only a suggestion of guidelines that the FTC encouraged the food industry to consider implementing in 5 years. That's like suggesting tobacco companies consider not marketing cigarettes to children in 5 years. We need tougher policies, not buckling to lobbying interests. The food industry has also decided to preempt any food labeling regulations that would give consumers real, credible information about the disease-causing or health-promoting effects of their products. At the request of the Centers for Disease Control, the Institute of Medicine, an independent scientific body, came out with food labeling recommendations in late 2011. That's why in early 2011, two major food industry trade associations, the Grocery Manufacturers of America and the Food Marketing Institute, announced a new and voluntary nutrition labeling system. Major food and beverage companies will use it on the front of packages to, quote, help busy consumers make informed choices, or to confuse the heck out of them. Their system lists the percents of various nutrients at their discretion. Most nutrition experts would have a hard time figuring out if the food was healthy or not, and that is the intent. In Europe, the red, yellow, and green labeling system provides consumers with an easy way to quickly assess their food choices. But the mantra of the food industry is that there are no bad foods. Nonsense. The science is clear. Trans fats and high fructose corn syrup are bad. So are pharmacologic doses of sugar. The general public also seems to prefer that the government not regulate what we eat. We accept that the government mandates auto safety regulations and that the FDA oversees drug safety, so why are we so resistant to oversight for the food and farming industries? After all, poor diet causes many more deaths than auto accidents. We certainly can't leave it to the toxic triad to police themselves. It didn't work for big tobacco. Why would it work for them? The causes of an obesogenic environment. There is an element of blaming the victim in all this that misses the environmental conditions that drive obesity and disease and lead to what is now being called an obesogenic environment. There are five main factors. One, industrial processed fast food and junk food are addictive. As we have seen, these foods are biologically addictive and drive excess calorie consumption. Big farming's influence increases obesity around the world. Surplus crops from the United States are sold cheaply to poor countries, which in turn destroys local farming economies and displaces farmers, creating unemployment and making developing nations dependent on imported processed food and corn syrup. Three, unethical, manipulative food marketing that drives eating habits. There is very little government control over big food's marketing practices, especially in marketing to children. The government licenses the airwaves, but doesn't police them. Four, families are not eating home-cooked meals together. Family mealtime has disappeared in much of America. There are many reasons for this, but it's been helped along largely by the proliferation of convenience or fast foods. This has led to a generation of Americans who have trouble recognizing vegetables and fruits in their original form and can't cook except in a microwave. Five, environmental toxins abound. These contribute to weight gain, obesity, and diabetes. We have to worry about not only what we eat, but also the burden of plastics, metals, and pollutants that have been shown to poison and slow our metabolism and lead to weight gain. To really change our obesogenic environment, we need to create healthier choices for everyone. We must focus on specific actions we can take personally, politically, and in our communities to alter our food landscape. Food marketing practices, are they ethical, moral, or legal? Big food takes advantage of the glut of processed food in our country to drive up profits through the use of mass media technologies. Other than drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, the number of hours of screen time is the single biggest factor correlating with obesity. The average American spends 9.5 hours a day in front of a screen, mostly television. In addition to the metabolism-slowing, hypnotic effect of watching television, relentless food marketing targeted to children is one of the major factors driving this problem. The average 2-year-old can identify, by name, junk food brands in the supermarket, but many elementary school children can't readily differentiate between a potato and a tomato, as Jamie Oliver demonstrated in his television program, Food Revolution. Think about this. If processed and junk foods are addictive, and we're pushing our children to consume them, what are the moral, ethical, and legal implications? The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is the largest organization working to address the epidemic of childhood obesity. They spend $100 million a year on public education and programs. How long do you think it takes the food industry to spend that amount, $100 million, on marketing processed and junk food to kids? 4 days. By January 4th each year, the largest funder fighting the battle against obesity is out of cash, leaving the food industry the rest of the year to push their drugs. The average child sees 10,000 ads for junk food on television a year. The food industry spends $13 billion a year marketing their products to kids. Adding to the television onslaught, there are now product placements in toys, games, educational materials, in songs and movies, celebrity endorsements, and stealth campaigns using word of mouth, text messaging, and the internet. The food industry proudly uses terms such as stealth, viral, and guerrilla marketing to describe their practices on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and in product placements in popular television shows such as American Idol, during which all the judges are drinking Coke, thanks to a multi-million dollar deal with the show. The worse the food, the more the companies spend on marketing. These activities do an end run around conventional marketing as well as societal and parental controls. If you spoke to your child before every meal about healthy eating, you could not compete with the onslaught of coercive messaging from industry. A Yale study found that kids who watched food ads ate 50% more of the snacks placed in front of them. The visual stimuli trigger the brain to eat more. Snacking, which is an American invention, is seen as fun, exciting, and ultimately the source of happiness. Dr. Kelly Brownell and his group from Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity published data that the breakfast cereals with the worst nutritional value had the most advertising. You can see more at cerealfacts.org. We stop Joe Camel. We also need to stop this type of marketing. It's unfair at best, drug dealing at worst. However, the government is shy about regulating food advertising. In 1978, the Federal Trade Commission ruled that sugary drink commercials were unethical because they promoted tooth decay. This was before the obesity epidemic. The beverage industry lobbied Congress, and Congress, in turn, chose not to give FTC money the next year. The FTC was stopped in its tracks since it didn't have the funds to push forward with legislation. The result? In the United States, food advertising to children knows almost no bounds. Yet in many other countries, including Sweden, Norway, and the United Kingdom, food advertising to children is banned. The Center for Science and the Public Interest brought a lawsuit against Coca-Cola for deceptive marketing practices of its vitamin water product. Coke hired celebrities like Kobe Bryant and LeBron James to tout its healthful effects. At 125 calories a bottle, drinking one bottle a day would make you gain about 10 pounds in a year. The minuscule amount of vitamins in the bottle is irrelevant compared to the sugar. The lawsuit is based on the jelly bean rule, which prohibits companies from selling junk foods with minimal health benefits by marketing them as healthy foods. The lawyers for Coca-Cola are defending the lawsuit by asserting that, quote, no consumer could reasonably be misled into thinking that vitamin water was a healthy beverage. Astounding. They defend themselves by saying that no one could be stupid enough to believe their ads, that this is actually a healthy drink. Well, just ask some average teenagers what they think. In 2005, the Institute of Medicine published its report on Food Marketing to Children and Youth, Threat or Opportunity. The Institute of Medicine was not permitted to review any internal research done by the food industry. Instead, the organization performed research focused on children, including preschoolers, to ferret out the psychological drivers of food choices. The report from the Institute of Medicine documents the comprehensive and deliberate effort made by the food industry to find ways to exploit the suggestibility of children. Remember, they are not just selling Nintendos, but substances that are proven to be addictive and cause obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. The IOM concluded that, quote, "We need to turn food and beverage marketing forces toward better diets for American youth and children." Some food companies appear to promote health and exercise programs and limit access to sugary drinks in schools, but they fall far short of their full potential, they say. While the food industry agreed to remove sugary drinks from schools under pressure from the Clinton Foundation, they later modified the agreement to allow vitamin waters and sports drinks, erasing whatever gains were made in making schools healthier. A recent study found that replacing sodas in school vending machines with sports drinks had zero impact on weight or health. It was good public relations, but just led to bigger profits for big food companies and bigger waist sizes for kids. Big food will not voluntarily sacrifice profits or change their foods or marketing practices. Its primary method for increasing profits is to get people to eat more. The IOM advises that Congress should enact legislation mandating the shift in food marketing practices. Big food and the government's response to studies like these is that, quote, individual choice drives decisions, that people choose for themselves how much unhealthy food they can or should consume. However, there are significant problems with this stance. In the first place, processed food is addictive. And research in behavioral economics shows that even when people think they are making free and rational choices, they are not. The addictive biology, pervasive advertising, cheap prices, and other social and environmental factors all work together to shape our food preferences. Americans support change. 72% of New Yorkers support a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages if the money is used for obesity prevention and treatment programs. 69% support changes in school nutrition. 51% support an outright ban on junk food advertising. What we can do to create a healthier nation and world. Our global health and economic crisis is blamed on the personal sins of sloth, gluttony, and a weak will. The scientific evidence and a deeper examination of political and corporate policies and behaviors does not support this indictment of the individual. This is all to say that while you may suffer from diabetes, it's not your fault. It's not that you're simply weak-willed. Resolving these problems will require community, social, and political changes that foster and encourage healthy choices. This starts with personal action and community organization. Creating a healthier world is a revolutionary act, one you can start right now. Remember the words of Margaret Mead: "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." In the next chapter, you will learn how a new science-based model of healthcare called functional medicine can be a lever for a sea change in how we approach illness and take back our health by addressing the causes of imbalances in our interconnected biological and social systems. Chapter 6, Functional Medicine, a New Approach to Reverse This Epidemic. The way modern medicine operates is like trying to diagnose what's wrong with your car by listening to the noises it makes instead of looking under the hood. We often miss the problems right in front of us. Most doctors would guarantee 100% that you don't have prediabetes if you have a normal blood sugar under 100, or a normal glucose tolerance test when your blood sugar is measured 2 hours after a sugary drink. Unfortunately, they are 100% wrong. That's because they don't look under the hood. Many of my patients have perfectly normal blood sugars, but sky-high insulin levels and every other metabolic breakdown that goes with prediabetes. And yet when they come to see me, most have not been diagnosed with prediabetes. Even with a limited conventional approach of diagnosing prediabetes as a blood sugar over 100 and a 2-hour glucose tolerance test over 140, 90% of people who are currently having the condition will not be diagnosed. This is because doctors don't measure insulin. Think about it for a minute. The most common chronic disease in America, the country with the best healthcare in the world, is not diagnosed in 90% of people who have it. Functional medicine, the future. My goal in medicine is to help provide a way to navigate and sort through health information based on an entirely new way of thinking about health and disease. I want to find the right treatment for each person, regardless of what that treatment might be. If a medicine is the best treatment, I'll choose that. If it's a change in diet or supplements or herbs or lifestyle that works best, then I'll choose that. We must learn to treat the person, not the disease. The system, not just the symptoms. This is personalized medicine, the medicine of the future. An understanding of the body's basic systems, how they get out of balance, and how to get them back in balance allows us to create an individualized program for each person. Dr. Ralph Snyderman of Duke University calls this P4 medicine or prospective medicine. It's personalized, it's preventive, it's predictive, and it's participatory, meaning that you have to actively participate in your own care. This is also known as patient-centered healthcare rather than disease-focused medicine, and it's a fundamental underpinning of functional medicine, a revolutionary new way to understand the underlying causes of disease and how our genes, our environment, and our lifestyle interact to determine health or disease. In functional medicine, we want to answer the question why, not just what is the right drug for this disease. The question isn't what disease do you have, but which system or systems in your body are out of balance. The goal is to understand what disturbs the normal function of these systems and how we can best create optimal function. I'm not so much interested in helping patients get the perfect lab test because, as we've seen, they don't tell the whole story. I'm interested in helping them identify how the particular systems in their bodies are working or not working, and then how we can get them into balance. This must be done by treating the whole system, not the symptom. It's like treating the soil, not the plant. Just as there's no need for fertilizer or pesticide, if the soil is healthy, there's no need for medication if your body is healthy. The continuum of disease, a more helpful way to diagnose illness. Most medicine today is based on clear-cut yes or no diagnoses that often miss the underlying causes and subtler manifestations of illness. Most conventional doctors are taught that either you have a disease or you don't. You have diabetes or you don't. There are no gray areas. Practicing medicine this way is plainly misguided because it misses one of the most fundamental laws of physiology and biology and disease, the continuum concept. There is a continuum from optimal health to hidden imbalance to serious dysfunction to disease. Anywhere along that continuum, we can intervene and reverse the process. The sooner we address it, the better. For example, when it comes to diabetes, most doctors just follow blood sugar, which only rises very late in the disease process. If your blood sugar is 90 or 110, you don't have diabetes. If it's over 125, you do have diabetes. But these distinctions are completely arbitrary, and they do nothing to help treat impending problems. I remember one patient, Darren, who came to see me with mildly elevated blood sugar.